Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
This is a one-star review. It's not often I finish reading a book having not enjoyed any part of it. First off, I must say, saying that in front of the author himself, a little harder than being behind a screen to go like, Nick, he's mid. I think his book, it's a lot harder to say that in front of you.
I've spent my life trying to get non-fantasy readers to read fantasy books. I don't want to brag here, but currently reading this bad boy.
Oh, come on.
Old Greek ruins, yeah, and there are drawings of penises in the ruins, like from the time. Like, dick jokes have been with us forever.
They're timeless. Da, 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 da.
Welcome everyone to a Tutor Realm podcast episode. My name is Richard.
My name is Austin.
Today, special day.
Special day.
We don't get these too many times, but today we get to interview an author, Nicholas Eames. We reviewed his book, Kings of the Wild, and he watched our video, saw that thumbnail, and was like, yeah, I want to push these guys right. I want to show them the correct way.
Mind Defend. You, the thumbnail... Nick, we got to talk because the thumbnail has me pointing to Kings of the Wild and in bold red letters with an evil villain face on me. I say this book is mid with all the heart and soul into that thumbnail. And then we actually review it and go detailed into the review. But Nicholas,
we play the thumbnail game a little bit.
Exactly. Nick, welcome. Thank you so much for coming on. And why did you come on? What is going on in your life?
Well, thanks for having me. Appreciate it. And thanks for the review as well. Yeah, I saw that thumbnail. And I mean, I understand you got to get clicks. You know, and sometimes you take something that everyone hates or everyone likes or whatever and just, you know, try to get a thing on it. So I was like, oh, I got to see this. And it was awesome. Like I went for a long run and listened to that podcast. And I just love when people, like, honestly, if someone takes the time to like deep dive your work, it's just such a huge honor. Like, it's something I would have dreamed of my entire life. So whether they like it or not, or whether they have fine faults with it or, you know, like certain parts of it, it's just awesome to hear.
That's so cool. We're going to talk about in this episode, just, hey, the author reader relationship and what do authors owe readers? What do readers owe authors? And a lot of part of that are reviews. We reviewed your book. You're on here now. And I imagine when this was your first book ever, Kings of the Wild. And when that first came out before it got popular, were you reading all of your reviews? Were you going, okay, every time on Goodreads or every time that someone made a video on it, you were watching everything? And now I imagine that's harder to do. But how did you go about that?
I was. When it first came out, I was pretty obsessed with Goodreads. I think perhaps a lot of authors are. Some of them are maybe too cool to worry about that. But I was pretty concerned about it. I think I liked probably every Goodreads review for the first 2 months, probably.
Awesome.
Yeah, I definitely like I read them, but I didn't ever like I've never been upset about a review unless it was just like, why is Moog gay? He didn't have to be gay, you know, that kind of stuff when people are like bigots about it. But otherwise, bad reviews never bother me. My dad used to every morning he would go on Goodreads, which he'd never used in his life before now. And he would drink his tea and he would read bad reviews and send them to me. Just because he knows that at this point I don't like I'm past it. All the good reviews.
Did you emulate one of your characters off your dad? Just that the guy humor of just like trashing each other, that kind of stuff.
No, because he's immensely proud of me, but he was just like, look at this. He'd probably take them more personally than I would.
Okay.
Yeah. He was defending you a little bit. Like, oh, look at this idiot.
Can you believe this? Or can you believe this? Yeah. But even he was just like, you know, and he's not like a fantasy reader or even a reader that much at all, but he's been really supportive about it.
Yeah. Do you find other authors in the space have that same mentality with reviews, or do you think you're an odd one out with this?
No, I think so. From what I've seen, a lot of debut authors tend to look at the reviews a lot, and whether they get warned, maybe not to. I know a lot of people have really terrible views of Goodreads. I actually don't. I think Goodreads is awesome. And until I have a book that's absolutely trashed on there, I will have that opinion. But for now, I mean, ultimately the books have pretty good ratings on there. And yeah, sometimes, I mean, I knew writing that book that it's just not for everybody. It wouldn't have been for me 5 years before I wrote it. Like, I would have hated it probably.
Right.
Rich,
you and I were saying in that review, like, you agree that it's a niche book for who it's targeted for loves it. Right?
Oh, exactly.
It does it great for that target audience.
There's definitely some aspects where I know that my enjoyment out of the book was definitely affected, but I didn't get all of the 70s rock references.
Yeah.
And reading back and doing like, and asking other people and going, oh, I missed quite a bit.
A lot,
like, yeah. That's a huge amount of the fun of the book. And the fact that I didn't get it is like, that's on me. That's not really on you as the writer. But
no, and
that's
you're not supposed to either. Yeah.
So that's a fun aspect of it. But yeah, if you're trying to make a book that pleases everyone, you'll please no one. So.
Yeah. And to be fair, my editor, I mean, when she first picked me up at, she was at Orbit, I think she was 25 years old. Like, she didn't get any of the references either.
Fair enough. Right.
So yeah, and hopefully I was trying to write it, because I certainly didn't know a lot of them before I started writing it. I didn't really listen to a lot of 70s rock. And then I listened to it for about 2 years straight. So I try to make them as, you know, under the radar as possible.
So Nick, now that we got started with this, and now that we got beyond our tension, like, you saw, we called your book mid. Now we can be somewhat friendly, fake it for an hour, then we'll be our separate ways.
There are no hard feelings, I promise.
So I have three reviews here that I'd love to hear your thoughts, and Rich, go back and forth on this a little bit. You know, you could defend him or you could be against him. However, I'm going to let you two take this how you will. I have a 5-star review of your book, a 1-star, and a 3-star review of your book, just to see what you think about the review, the reaction, and we'll just go from there, okay?
Sounds great.
The very first review is a 5-star review. And this person says, an absolute blast from the first page to the last, and quite simply one of the greatest fantasy books of all time. As a prolific reader of fantasy books and very involved in the fantasy book reviewing community, I've had people recommend that I read Kings of the Wild. I've been very clear with people that one of my largest criteria for whether a book is good or not is how much fun it is to read. And virtually everyone I've spoken with about this book claims it to be one of the most fun fantasy books written in years. I am pleased to say that not only do I fully agree with this assessment, I would go a major step further and say this is one of the greatest fantasy books ever written. 5 stars. And this isn't just a normal 5 stars. This is from, do you recognize the review at all, Nick?
Yeah, it's my mom.
Basically as honorable, like, your mom and this person would be up there. This is Matt's fantasy book reviews from another booktuber who we love watching his reviews, but loves your book that much. And also, it being a booktuber, it's got to be great, because unlike us, we're meaner to your book. Matt loved it, and he had a review, I believe, on his channel, but he wrote this on Goodreads. What's your reaction to a review where you make someone care that deeply?
That's the best, because honestly, the whole reason I set out to be a writer was I read my favorite author's books. His name's Guy Gavriel Kay. And they affected me deeply, and changed who I was as a person at a pretty fundamental time in my life. And I was reading one of his books in particular, Lord of Emperors, which is about leaving a legacy behind, whether you're an artist, an emperor, whatever you do. And reading that book on a very specific page, even, I was like, I need to be an author so I can affect someone the way this book affects me. And although I've never quite reached Guy Gavriel Kay levels, and somebody on Reddit once compared, they liked both books, but they compared him to a steak dinner and me to Chipotle, which is fair. I know now that I have, and like, I get emails and or even reviews like that. And so they mean the absolute world to me. And they're by far the best thing I find about being an author, for sure.
Rich, I had to pause the Nicholas Eames interview here just for a second.
Why?
I'm having a bad day.
Is it because of Nicholas Eames?
No. It's because I don't have a Displate. Rich, what is Displate?
Displate is a premium metal poster that actually is a significant upgrade from your college paper or plastic poster that you try to fancy up by putting in a frame. Doesn't work. Never works. Just get yourself a display. Premium metal. Oh. Premium metal posters that actually look good on your wall.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Displate is offering everybody a 22% discount if you use the code 2TORAMBLE at checkout, or check out the link in the description below. Also, you can get 30% off if you get three or more displates. Rich put it best. They are metallic posters you have to get. They look great. We own so many of them. We put them all over our place. Oh, thank you, Rich. Wow. If you're listening to audio only, this makes no sense, but this is Displate. We love them. They have sponsored us since basically day one. Thank you, Displate, for sponsoring us. We hope you check them out and continue with the Nicholas Eames interview.
That's awesome. I mean, Rich, with five stars, yeah. You have your five-star books out there.
Oh, yeah.
And when you give something five stars, that much love.
It definitely means it changed how I see the world. I think that's almost a requirement for the... If I'm giving something the five-star, it means... This has deeply affected me, and my life is not really the same afterward. That I'm going to view things a little differently.
You have a high criteria for your five.
A little bit.
Pretty high, yeah.
I don't know. It just mainly is I see the world a little differently now.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't even have to be in a big way, really. Just I've never looked at something this way before, and now my eyes are open to it.
Yeah. Off the top of your head, what are like some of your favorite, your five stars? Like if you had to name...
Right off the top of my head, yeah. Pure Nessie by Susanna Clarke is five star for me. I loved Hyperion. Hyperion is one of my favorite sci-fi books I've ever read. Up there would probably be actually book three of Sun Eater. Demon in White is up there. And then from Brandon Sanderson, Emperor's Soul. I think that's definitely his best writing that he's made. I mean,
yeah,
it is the book that actually won the Hugo Award for him as well. So
yeah,
those are a couple, and I think on the totality of a whole Wheel of Time.
Yeah,
not any individual book, but
all of it together makes it fun.
And then name a Discworld book, and I'll get
The Color of Magic.
Fair enough. You caught me. You caught me there.
Nick's maybe on top of his one. Game.
Maybe not that one. But Small Gods, Going Postal, Guards.
Yeah.
Aces.
Phenomenal.
Nick, I hate to make you say this again, but when you had a conversation with Mike's Book Reviews. We love Mike. We had him on the channel. Awesome guy. And you were talking to him about God Gave Her Okay and how he made you cry in high school is one of the first ones you picked up, and you love the book that much. Neither of us have read Guy Gavre. Okay, we hear Tigana and the Al Rashad. Is that the other book he has as well?
The Lions of Al Rasan.
Al Rasan.
Yeah.
Which one would you recommend for Rich and I to that you think is a five star read for him that could be a series or a standalone, like of Guy Gavre? Okay, assuming he's one of your favorites, right? As we just
said earlier. I think he's the greatest human writer to ever live.
Wow.
And once I saw Brandon Sanderson giving this class, and he said, you know, he puts those classes on YouTube, and he said there are, I think he said, two geniuses writing fantasy today, and he wrote on the board Terry Pratchett and Guy Gavriel K. That was when Terry Pratchett was still alive.
Wow.
And I was like, okay, Sanderson, he knows, that's he gets it.
That's definitely the best pitch pitch for it, because I do consider Terry Pratchett one of the most genius writers to ever live.
Oh, yeah.
I now look at prose differently because of him.
Mm-hmm.
The ability to be able to, within the same sentence, being able to push the plot forward, to give you more about a character, to let you discover a little bit more about the world, and with humor that normally works at the same punchline as three separate jokes.
Yeah.
All within such a short span is... nothing short of genius. It is why I love Terry Pratchett as much as I do. I think I would consider him my favorite author. Maybe, like, it's a hard thing. Like, I think he's probably one of the best authors I've ever read.
Oh,
and
for sure.
He's definitely my favorite. I've smiled the most with him.
It's such smiles. And I imagine Guy Gavriel, okay, he is he as witty as Terry Pratchett, or is it a different kind of prose? What makes him so great?
No, he writes more like beautiful, sentimental kind of stuff.
Got it.
And his earlier books, there is definitely like he has kind of an arc of his career. His earlier books, his first book is a trilogy that is like an homage to Lord of the Rings, like very much so. He helped Christopher Tolkien compile the Silmarillion. So he was like really, really like close with that. And so his first series is very, very raw. It's about people from like the University of Toronto taken to a fantasy world, which when I first read it, I was like, this is the stupidest idea I have ever heard in my life. King Arthur's in there. Like the main character's names are like Paul. And I'm like, stop this. This is nuts.
Atreides.
That's just crazy. And then cut to a couple days later and I was bawling my eyes out. But then he wrote a lot of kind of like raw standalones. And after what is my favorite book of all time, Lord of Empires, which is the second part of a duology, his books after that became less kind of like raw and emotional and vital and a bit more like philosophical and beautiful. And so they kind of appeal to it. Like he aged, his books aged almost, and they appeal to an older audience. But I would say if you're going to start with one Guy Gabriel Kay book, I think it is Lines of Auversant. It's just great. The first time I read it, it opens up with like a doctor looking at someone's urinal flasks in the market. And I think I was maybe 20 years old. And I was like, no, let me back to Dritz Stewart and please, this person is not wielding a scimitar in both hands. And I put it down and it was the stupidest thing I ever did. Cause I went back about a year later and read it. And now that's one of the only books I ever reread. And I start crying earlier in the book every single time. Cause I know what's coming.
That's the Lines of Auversant. That's the one that you cry with every time. But your favorite is what was that called in the duology?
The Lord of Emperors.
The Lord of Emperors. Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome. Because we are excited to touch Guy Gabriel. Okay. We always hear Tigana. We'll take you up on Rassan or that series. Probably because Rassan is standalone.
Yes.
Then that would be good to touch in to see Guy Gabriel. Okay. First to get a standalone and then go into a series. That would be awesome. And that just going off that 5-star review, are you prepared now? Did we bubble this up enough to give you a 1-star review?
I love 1-star reviews.
Pretend we're your dad for a second, reading this to you off the Goodreads. Okay. This is a 1-star review. Here we go. It's not often I finish reading a book having not enjoyed any part of it, but this was one of those rare occasions. Almost from the start, I was questioning on what basis had so many people awarded Kings of the Wild 5-star ratings, and why it appeared on so many end-of-the-year best-of lists in 2017. I couldn't for the life of me work out why, and so found myself thinking, more than once, that if this is truly one of the best fantasy novels published last year, then 2017 was a poor year for the genre. Eventually, I just had to accept that I'm not the target audience for the novel. Without meaning to sound insulting, I think that this book that plays well with juvenile people who get a cheap thrill out of juvenile humor. Since that's just not me, the childish comedy that saturates the story from beginning to end only served to aggravate me and make me roll my eyes. When all said and done, reading the book was a hard slog, and I was glad when it was finally over. Needless to say, I have zero interest in reading the sequel. First off, I must say, saying that in front of the author himself, a little harder than being behind a screen to go like, Nick, he's mid. I think his book, it's a lot harder to say that in front of you, I gotta say.
This is a fun moment for us of just personally being able to talk about things online. Yeah. You don't often get to actually interact with the people you're talking
Keyboard
about.
Warriors, like, I hate your book, and now you got
but
it.
But now,
front, right?
We actually we get to talk to you directly.
I mean, I promise, I am unoffendable when it comes to if someone doesn't like my book, I promise. Like, you can't possibly. That's actually a pretty thoughtful 1-star review. Usually 1-star reviews are just, like, kind of hateful.
Right.
I find it's the 2- and 3-star reviews that are, they're more meticulous, almost like that one that will like pick it apart why they didn't like it. And to be honest, that guy's like, this book was on multiple bestseller lists for 2017, and this book has tons of 5-star reviews. Like, he's doing me a solid.
It's almost advertising.
Or they. Yeah, who knows who it is. And especially if someone doesn't like the humor, then 100% they're just not going to like the book, you know? Like,
definitely.
Bail out as soon as possible.
Oh, no. There's very vastly different types of humor sets, and none of them I don't think are like, not one's better than the other, but there's such a drastic difference between something like Terry Pratchett's humor and even Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Douglas Adams. Like, they're both considered like sci-fi absurdist humor, or well, one sci-fi, one's fantasy, but vastly different styles of humor. Both are equally valid, I think, but we have different tastes.
For sure. And that's one big thing with this last review, super short, 3-star, then we can go beyond this. This 3-star review says, not only is Kings of the Wild a mid book, but he, Nicholas Eames, has a mid last name. And do you know who that was?
Jesus, no.
That was me on the review we did.
Mid last name. Oh, yes, I remember that. I remember that. Yeah.
It was only because I couldn't pronounce your name, so I had to throw that in there. Yeah. I just had to put that.
It is a mid-last name. It means son of the uncle, which if you'd met my uncle, you'd know it makes a lot of sense.
Now that we know how to pronounce it, love it. The book, I can't say it was my 5-star, but I'm just giving you that perspective of, hey, when we were reviewing your book, we were doing our best. Like, I like what you said with the 1-star review of usually they're worse because they just have so much hate for the book. That
they're blinded by it, that they're not really even looking at the book. There was one aspect of the book, and then that clouded the rest of the judgment.
Like Nynaeve pulled her braid, and I just can't get over it. I can't stop, right? And so the 2-star reviews, or your 4-star, maybe even your 4-stars have more insight than their 5, because they have something to pull on each end. But just us going of the tough thing we have reviewing in our channel is we want keeping it honest. This is what we actually think about the book and getting across as a reviewer. Hey, here's our taste, because that's all we can do is if you know our taste, kind of align the books you read with that. Rich, what do you think of the best thing you could do as a reviewer? And then we can get into like reader and author.
Sure.
And that whole dynamic.
I at least think of my job as making myself as clear as possible on why I liked a book and why I didn't. And so that someone could get value whether they agree with me or not. Yeah. And that if I'm very clear on why I dislike a book, that could be someone's reason to pick it up. Equally so to the reverse.
I like that.
So hopefully, as long as I'm not just saying like, I liked it, go read it, I'm actually giving details, that's helpful either way.
Right. Because Nick, I know you were before, was this before you, no, it might have been after you wrote Kings of the Wild that you reviewed books on your blog for a little bit.
Yeah, just a couple as I was coming out. I mean, nowadays I'm pretty active on Goodreads and I'll review them there, but no longer on my website. Yeah.
Did you have a job you put in mind when you were reviewing something, or did you just see it as a very, like, what kind of expectations did you put on yourself?
These days if I don't like a book, I just don't review it. And that kind of goes along with like a policy I have. I mean, that kind of started right off the bat as like a professional, just like maybe don't piss people off. Cause you might not even be worried about the author, but their editor could be your editor someday, or you could rely on them, you know? And the readers as well might get pissed off if you don't like a book that they like. But it's more just like, I kind of started to have a general policy of not saying anything negative on the internet. And it's hard. Boy, oh boy, sometimes I'm just like,
yeah,
you know, I got the tweet ready to go. And I'm like, no, delete it. And so, yeah, if I don't like a book, I usually just like disappear it off my Goodreads. And otherwise, it's just kind of like letting people know that I loved it. And if they like what I like, and they can see me spam stuff all the time about, you know, anime or God knows what I like, then they just know they might like it too.
Yeah, that's a hard thing for we both one day want to be authors as well, but it does seem to be a general policy amongst authors of, hey, fellow authors, don't badmouth each other. Just, you know, that's not really cool. That does seem to be a general, not policy, but general behavior amongst most authors.
Like an unwritten rule, almost?
I guess so.
Yeah, because us parasites that just review and don't create, we can sit in our high horse and be like, here's what's wrong with the book.
Yeah.
Here's what I liked about the book. But then, hey, one day when, I think this is happening with people like Daniel Green, who has a huge BookTube channel and then makes a book, and you get to a certain level of attention to where you have to be more careful about, like, should you trash something because it makes it's, is it punching down at a certain point? Because you get so big, is it punching down? Because even for us, Nick, as much as we could, like, let's say we 1-starred your book, we'd still be punching up. You know, we're still not at Nicholas Eames level. So that's my one compliment I'll make. That's it. That's all you get. But then, it almost feels like you're, you know, reviewing a big blockbuster movie, and who's going to really look down at you when you're saying like, oh, I didn't like the latest Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
Or Jurassic World versus, oh, I didn't like this indie film that was made in like the back skirts of wherever. So there's like a stigma there with reviews. But then for you, Nick, what kind of framework do you put as an author? What do you think you owe the audience, if you owe them anything at all? Do you think that the author's obligated to something?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think as an author, you can benefit greatly from interacting with people, whether it's positively or maybe not negatively, but just like honestly, at least, and being considerate. But ultimately, it kind of is up to each author to decide, I think. I think a lot of authors, and it's not something I realized until I was in the business, and is also like our day and age, that like a lot of authors struggle with mental health issues, and especially maybe once they get published, because boy, oh boy, it's harder than I like anticipated. Like I've been extremely fortunate, but a lot of authors see their dreams come true and then their book doesn't sell well, and they see their dream evaporating. And if they're getting one-star reviews or brutal reviews, like, and especially from someone maybe that they admire, it could be devastating to them. But then again, there's all those conversations out there about, you know, authors that take a long time to finish books. I suppose I am now one of those authors, although not quite on the blockbuster mm-hmm. level of like a Scott Lynch or a Patrick Rothfuss. But yeah. I honestly don't think they owe me anything. Like as a reader, don't care. Loved your book. I'd rather you not leave me on a huge cliffhanger, which none of these authors have. Mm. And otherwise, yeah, you don't owe me a damn thing.
I tend to agree with you on that message with the caveat there. If the author doesn't owe the reader anything, then the reader doesn't owe the author anything. In the same vein of, so I remember several months ago of George R. R. Martin talked about it in his blog posts. And my stance on it, like, hey, I don't think Martin owes the fans really anything on the book. Like, should he finish the series? Yeah, I should. But really, they don't owe him anything. However, his insistence on like kind of his antagonistic approach toward a lot of his fans in his blog and kind of the expectation of when he's releasing something else that's not Game of Thrones, you know, it's not Song of Ice and Fire. A lot of people are just not interested in that because he's not finishing the main series.
Yeah.
And so my point would be the readers don't owe the author anything if the author's not completing the work that the readers want. It kind of goes both ways of
100%.
Yeah. With you see a lot online of, I mean, you could create whatever timeline you want for what is too long to not have a book out. And like you have your Scott Lynch, Rufus and Martin are the big ones for that. And Scott Lynch avoids a lot of it because I think Scott Lynch, there's more of the stigma, definitely George R. R. Martin, because of how popular Game of Thrones is.
It's not that he's not releasing it. And this is just, I think anyone says like, oh, I'm going to do this. And then they don't. And it's the going back on your word, where Scott Lynch, I don't think has made any type of promise when it'll be released. And he's mentioned before, having his own mental health problems. And so kind of people said, okay, go ahead, do it. Take the time you need then. And as long as you don't make a false promise, then I think everyone's good.
And with something as big as Game of Thrones and Song of Ice and Fire, where George R. R. Martin, I bet you every time he posts something, he just sees comments that are, when's the book coming? Yeah. When's the book coming? And that could probably make it worse.
It probably makes it really annoying for him.
Yeah. And because Nick, from the author's point of view, what do you think about, people obviously come to George and come to these other authors and like, give us the book. You know, we want the next book. It's been how many years now? Or 12, 13 years, something like that, 14?
Something like that.
But then on the you're getting the author's insight of it's not that easy to write a book, and especially something that's set up that long. But what's your take on all of that, on the author and reader, how long it takes to release a book? And what is, again, you're saying nothing's owed, but maybe something deeper than owed of what should be reasonable.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great question. I as someone, like when I was an aspiring author, like I loved Scott Lynch, and you know, those first two books came out pretty like one right after the other. And then his third book was coming out, and I was just like, God, where is this thing? And then I've learned about his mental health issues, and I'm like, one of the most callous things I ever thought at the time, I remember, was like, you know what's the cure for depression is reading The Lies of Locke Lamora. Buddy, just read that first book. But, you know, that's not going to help. Reading what many would consider a perfect book, like I definitely love that book, is not going to help when you're struggling with another one, you know? But yeah, I definitely too have struggled writing this third book. And as someone who's now like experiencing it, there is like nothing you would love to do more than finish it. And I guarantee you that goes for George R. R. Martin, Patrick Rothfuss, Scott Lynch. Nothing in the world. Nobody, not even the biggest fanboy, wants it done as much as they want it done. But sometimes when it comes to a certain point, you cannot do it. And your mind, at least my mind, sometimes when I try to think about it, and granted, like I'm still working on it pretty much every day, it just bounces off the idea of it. It just, you cannot make yourself physically do it, because it's just nothing there when it comes to that particular work. And I have, you know, been fortunate enough to write some comics, trying to work on maybe like a novella or short stories based in like the same world. And it's so much easier to work on other stuff a lot of the time. And so I know like someone like George or Patrick Rothfuss, yeah, whenever he posts anything, he's like, oh, it's my dad's birthday or my daughter's birthday. It's like, fuck you, where's my tree? You know? And it's just like, as someone who gets that, like, that kind of vitriol all the time, he must just be like, I can see why he gets antagonistic about it. And even just, I can post something, I think I maybe posted something today, and someone's like, book three, when? And it definitely like stresses you out. But I have found at least that just writing back to the person and being like, hey man, I'm working on it, it's been really rough, immediately they're like, oh yeah, no pressure, no worries about it at all. So it's easy, especially like I said, I was in that boat. I was like, cure depression, read your first book. It's tough.
I did want to give clarification with Patrick Rothfuss, because over time I've seen kind of two things develop of there's the one aspect of it's been a while since Doors of Stone, and you know, that's one aspect of it. It's taken him quite a while. He's going over his mental health issues. And then there was the point of he had a charity event where he said he would release, like he already had finished chapter one and he was going to release it for the charity, and they completed the goal. Yeah. And he didn't release it.
I remember
it.
That. Yeah.
So I think nowadays there's definitely it's a little different nowadays compared to yourself and Scott Lynch, of you guys haven't promised anything that you aren't delivering. Yeah. It's going to take you it's going to take you however long it's going to take you. And
I also imagine like when the author, so I don't know the roughest situation with the chapter, what happened there other than like he said he was going to release it, didn't release it. That's the crux of it.
From his writing, he seems to be a very perfectionist type writer.
Oh, yeah.
And hey, from his first book, like I know it's beautifully written. I may not like the plot that much, but he goes over every single word. Mm-hmm. And so he's looking through it, that scrutiny. I guess he just doesn't want to produce a chapter one that he may change or something like that.
Right. So Nick, for you and for book three, rather than the when it's going to be released, do you think it's harder for that longer in the series, because since the series gotten more popular, is it putting more pressure that's bad, or is it something else that makes it hard for these authors like you or anybody that's in a series and it gets longer to take the second book, then the second to the third and so forth? Is part of that pressure?
Yeah, I think it might be. But at the same time, like, you know, like I'm not as popular as someone like, say, Rebecca Kwong, who's pumping out books left, right, and center.
Right.
You know, she's able to produce them a lot quicker. Someone like Mark Lawrence is very popular, and he doesn't even edit his books, for God's sake. He just puts them out. Good. And they're
does
poetic.
Does he really not edit them?
He doesn't even edit. He doesn't revise. He does nothing. Like, as far as what I've gleaned is that he just writes it, and it is done. And he's, like, pretty poetic writer. Like, there's a couple times where if I read a whole book and I don't turn over a page, like the corner, to be like, that was a beautiful paragraph, I probably won't read that author again. I wouldn't hate the book, but I probably wouldn't read the author again. And he just nails it somehow.
Wow, I didn't realize that. Like, I'm sure he has an editor of sorts,
but he doesn't edit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you definitely need to read the Red Sister, like Book of the Ancestors trilogy.
Okay.
He's only read
Book That Wouldn't
Book That Wouldn't Burn.
Yeah.
So context. Okay.
Yeah.
Not as well versed in.
No, I imagine he's great. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, part of it can be pressure. I know when I was writing Bloody Rose, I was under like a deadline, which I blew that deadline, but not by much comparatively. And I was in the worst mental health state I've ever been in my whole life. And this was like a year after my, like all my lifelong dream had come true. And I was the most unflappable person. Like I was always, my brother's a little bit more positive than me, but I was always so positive. And yet my dream had come true and I was writing Bloody Rose and I was miserable. I would go to bed every single night thinking like, okay, how many words did I get today? How many words do I need to write tomorrow to catch up to this like deadline? And I would like be awake for hours and then do it again the next night and then the next night. And I was just miserable. And then I finished it and turned it in. And I think I'd started on the third book. And then I don't know what happened. I can't like point to a specific like event or time, but I basically just had this thing inside me snap and go, your happiness means more than anything. Just be happy every day. If writing doesn't make you happy that day, don't do it. You know? And it's weird because now I do still have like a little bit of like, you know, I want to turn my book in for my editors because I love them as human beings and my readers because I love them as well. And my parents so that they can see it and not worry about me or something like that. But it's just not something I just even let myself stress over anymore. And I'm not capable of it just because something just went, don't do this to yourself, you know?
Is this something different than your standard writer's block? Do you feel is it some of the outside pressure or is it just internally of trying to continue something that has now been built up and you don't really know how it's going to go? Like, what do you think that pressure is? And is it different from maybe writer's block on a first book, like a book one?
Yeah. For me, I think so. I think part of it is, perfection, a little bit of perfectionism, although you know what you create isn't going to be perfect. But
well, clearly the one star review from that
guy Gavril, you know, K or Terry Pratchett. Terry Pratchett.
I mean, make no mistake, to me, I read Kings of the Wild, and to me, I'm like, except for one sentence on the very first page, perfect book, absolutely flawless.
Oh, what's the sentence? Come on now,
you can't tell us that. And
I mean, it's really simple, it's the stupidest thing, but it's like, I think he says finished with work for the day, and I would just change it to finished work for the day. And it bothers me. Yeah.
Yeah.
Finished
with work for the day. Clay slogged down the beaten track that passed for a thoroughfare in Coverdale.
That's a good correction.
That's a very good correction. Hold on a minute.
Lower the rating on the scale, Rich. It goes down.
I'm grabbing my pen.
He's grabbing his pen to cross it out. Wait, that's my book. Yours is the other one.
I'm gonna grab this pen.
Nick, that line there. How often do you reread your book?
Not like a ton. Reread the whole thing. I think probably about 3 years ago was the last time I reread both of them in a hopes of like getting into that headspace again.
Yeah.
And I think it does help because, especially when you're writing like the third book, which has to kind of like, even though they're all standalones, I want it to cap off the trilogy. And also it's a bit, the third one is a bit more serious because the first one, they're all very much based on the genre of music that inspired them.
Yeah.
So the first one is 70s. So it's a bit more like freewheeling, you know, happy go lucky. And then the second one, like, you know, when all those bands were just like getting famous for the first time ever and what that felt like. And then the second book is more like the 80s style and those bands that were trying to go harder, faster than the people that came before them. And you look at bands like Guns N' Roses that just like, imploded, you know, they exploded and then imploded so quickly. And it was like that self-destructive drive to be famous. And that's kind of what the second book is. And then with the third book is kind of like 90s. And a lot of that 90s music is kind of anti-establishment, whether it's hip hop or whether it's grunge, it's a bit more serious in nature. And the world itself that I've kind of made has become more serious. And just like that, there is some stuff in Bloody Rose that starts to look at how, you know, now that humankind is the upper hand against what they consider monsters, how do they treat those creatures? And is it right? And was it right to put them in arenas and fight them and breed them and all that kind of stuff? And spoiler alert, probably not. so it's a bit more serious. So part of it is just like, wanting to do it perfectly. And I think this is the way probably someone like Patrick Rothfuss feels, even though he's obviously like way bigger than I am, is it's not so much like you're not doing it to get paid. You're not doing it to impress people. You want to leave behind, and I want to leave behind, like the thing I am the most proud of. And you only get one chance at it. So I am so, so fortunate right now to be able to, like, I can, like, right now live off my royalties, not extravagantly, but I only get one crack at it. So I think that's in my head that I don't care who else likes it as long as I do.
Before I ask this question too, Rich went into his book and he crossed out the with.
Just to
make this book more perfect. Could you do that for mine too? I'm now a little jealous. I need to do that.
I don't like writing my book, but I give the exception of the author's edit. Official.
Could you do that for mine too?
There we go.
Do that for me. Thank you. while he's doing that, does it seem like for you a little bit of it is it's combining the creative process with business? Because mixing those two and mixing you're doing, this is the thing that you're proudest of. This is the thing that means the most to you. And it's what it's your absolute dream. And you get to do that and decide when you do it. And especially for your first book, there was nothing. It was just, you write it when you want. You were unknown. No one needed anything from you. And now, did you feel like there was some business presence of, okay, now I have deadlines. Now I have all these things that before I don't want to lose what to me is more meaningful, the happiness and this creativity and this long-lasting legacy is way more important than this date, arbitrary date.
100%. 100%. I think, and obviously I'm a terrible example of it, but I think deadlines are just terrible. You know, I understand from publishers, they have, you know, it's a business and they need to keep themselves afloat, especially in these days. But I just think I know a lot of authors that have rushed their books you know, for a deadline, pretty famously, like The Traitor, Barrow Cormorant. You ever read that book?
No.
Like, oh, I fucking loved that book by Seth Dickinson. And he also has some pretty major mental health struggles, but he also very famously, like, turned his second book in before he was happy with it. And he took a beating for it. But I mean, if you ever get a chance, that first book does read as a perfect standalone. So
I think I'm noticing with some here. So just to see, clearly, I've seen other interviews with you beforehand here, and I like to see, you know, I'm not comparing us at all, you know, because I can't do that, but I have that same, like, this is, and Rich can attest to, we love stories so freaking much. That's why we have this channel. That's just why we talk sci-fi fantasy with everybody. Like, we just engross ourselves in this stuff.
Yeah.
And it means so much. We think the stories are the most meaningful thing ever. Period. Stop. It's everything. So.
It's how lessons are learned. We can only live one life. And if we were to be limited by our own experiences, our lives would be, you know, great, but
less great.
Less.
Yeah.
The fact that we have stories means that us as individuals can live more than what we ever could in our own natural lives.
And Nick, you put a great, when you were talking to Mike, we're saying, hey, if I could ever make someone feel the way Guy Gavril K made me feel when I touched that book, that would be a life worth living. That's amazing. And I want to argue something to both of you. You both said authors owe nothing to readers. I'm making it extreme. With a caveat.
Yeah,
sure.
But saying that maybe one thing authors owe is like what you're doing and what true authors are doing is just some authenticity. Like an actual some heart or something that is, if you are asking someone to read your book, you at least have to go like, hey, I'm writing this for quote unquote the right reasons, whatever those right reasons are. It doesn't have to be a good book, could be a bad book. They could try, but maybe something authentic is better than if there's other intentions to writing the book, if that makes sense. What do you guys think of that? Because I'm gonna see where that goes. Let that fly. What do you think, Nick?
Well, one thing that I thought when you just like first talked about this question was, if the author owes the reader anything, like I feel like a lot of that exchange can happen during the course of reading the book. For instance, like there's an author that I really liked, and then I was reading a series of his that just like wasn't flying. It was pretty good, but it was not phenomenal. But then at one point, a dragon came in, and suddenly the word vast was used 5 times in 3 pages. And I put that book down, and I have never read another one of his books since. And I was just like, you know what? If you don't care, because I am, granted.
driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big this summer with great deals, all in the Kroger app. Get select varieties of Powerade or Body Armor Super Drinks for 79 cents each. Then get a 2-pound package of strawberries for $2.99 each, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Really particular about double words, like nuts.
God.
And so I was like, if you don't care about this, then I don't care either. Cause like, I'm a huge prose guy. And I, like, that means more to me than most things in a book, more than the story and stuff like that. And so I was just like, I don't. So to me, like that author owed me and their editor owed me more care in writing it.
Right. Almost if they seem like they didn't care, why should you invest in that? And that I like the analogy of like a book is a 10-hour marriage. If they're not going to also vow to you at least that, then why give them your time? Because you are asking a reader to provide X number of time. At the very least, be like, hey, I'm trying to make it worth your time. I can't promise it, but I at least tried.
Yeah.
Rich, would you jump on that bandwagon?
I mean, sure. It makes me think of, In many ways, books, I think, a little bit easier in this aspect. If it is a book written by one person, like, it's kind of hard to imagine that person not all the hours you put into a book, you're trying your best for the most part. There's very few times where I would think about, like, an author that has put so much time into their work and they're half-assing it.
It's harder just for kinda, authors. Yeah.
And maybe there are, and I just haven't noticed, or those are the people I just don't read. Very well could be. Because people like, I don't know. I'm trying to think of people that would say that. I don't know if I would agree, but I've heard things like Dan Brown has a formula to his writing, and that, all the Dan Brown books are the same. And he just churns them out. I personally don't feel that way. I think he does care about his books. He figured out his style of writing.
Yeah.
I'm not particularly against, but I would think that would be the example someone would think about.
Gotcha.
Of an author just doing it for the money and not trying to, not putting their soul into it.
I see what you mean. Yeah. Nick, I don't know how often that is. You don't have to name names, but I imagine
I don't even agree with that. No. Just what I've... You ask someone of like the, you know, the airport book, the stuff that is,
right.
You know, they're churning out 3 books a year of incredible thickness. You go like, how could he do this? And you kind of think, oh, this is all the same. But
it's very difficult answer me if I'm wrong here, but very hard for, it doesn't seem like authors go business first, then creativity. It seems like anybody that wants to write a book, usually it's creativity first, the meaning behind it. I think that could be, there's a smaller barrier to entry when it comes to other fields, but writing in general, I know there's a lot of people into it, the editors and everything around that, but it's a very personal journey for, it's your book. And then also the people that along that supported you. And obviously there's a lot that goes into that, but unlike some other things like a movie that needs, even the director, I would say the director has less, it's less the director's film than it is the author's book. I think the author, definitely. Like even though the director's directors, you need so many more parts, but the author is such a, it's one person. Yes, there's others, but it is one person's essentially their thing. So it's very hard maybe to get it to that creativity business line where a lot of authors, and I don't know if you know, in the author sphere of it, is that mostly the case where no one's really going into it because, oh, I'm going to make a big buck writing these long fantasy books that take me years. I don't think that's the case.
No, and I think, I mean, if people think they're going to get rich writing fantasy books, holy God, they've got another thing coming. Obviously, it happens once in a while, but I definitely didn't fully grasp it before I got into it. So I think, especially for that first book, and I tell a lot of people, like if someone writes me, you know, asking for advice, one of the things I often say is just like, make sure you love it and have other things in your life that make you happy too, because it could become a source of stress. So you got to really, really enjoy it.
What is a way that you try to combat or avoid the stress of now being a published author with this kind of weight and expectation on your shoulders? Because I know you talked about, like, you said, hey, my happiness is worth more than that. How do you go about that? What's kind of the things that you do that when the stress kind of gets to you?
I just kind of like enjoy other people's creativity. I find, like, obviously I'm a huge fan of video games, movies, TV shows. I find if I watch like a TV show, especially, it's long enough. It's not like a movie where they're trying to get all this information at once, or like a 20-minute episode of anime, which I also love, where it's everything's so condensed. Mm-hmm. But a TV show, it's like comfortable in its own skin. It's not trying to tell the story too quickly. And in watching that often, my mind starts to riff off ideas in that. And I have time to think about other, like my own work, because it isn't demanding my attention 100% of the time. And obviously different strokes for different folks. I try to read books that are, and this works totally different from other authors, but that are similar to my own, that have a same like lighthearted feeling. Like when I saw like James Gunn's Suicide Squad, I was like, oh, that's what I'm trying to do. Like that's kind of my kind of stuff. Or even the Dungeons and Dragons movie. I watched it with my niece and nephew again last night. And it's like so funny, but so, my God, I cried at the end.
Oh,
you know,
like that mixture of both humor but also sentiment.
Yeah,
maybe your two favorite authors, or correct me if I'm wrong, but Guy Gavrocki, sentimental, Terry Pratchett, incredibly witty and humorful. Maybe you like the mix of the juxtaposing just emotions, that when someone can make you laugh and then cry, I love that. The Nick, or is that, or
to give the best like actual example from your book,
yeah,
to that, it Mook,
mm-hmm,
Mook, yeah, is that, yep, perfect point of,
yeah,
he is arguably the funniest character of the band, but also the one that has the most emotional weight.
Definitely.
I mean, everyone that we talked to in our book club about it, like, Moog was the favorite character.
Yeah.
By far the favorite character of the moment. I think it was my favorite part of the book, of him talking about how, why he was going to solve the, try and cure the rot after his husband has already passed, of not wanting to let that same pain go to anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
Such a touching moment for him, of like always thinking about others. And
well, thank you for saying so.
I don't know, that was just that was the moment for me. I what I really liked about his character, and especially just how silly he is. And often you see that with, I think maybe a lot of comedians have that word.
Oh, totally.
A lot of very funny people, their comedy and humor is maybe a coping mechanism, or it's hides something deeper and beneath.
Yeah, and some of the great comedians too, especially once you start laughing and you kind of let your guard down and feel you can relate to either the author or those characters or the comedian. Look at someone like George Carlin, who then would tell you something profound or talk about profound issues in some way. And so on a much smaller scale, that's kind of what I tried to do. Less like Kings of the Wild was really like fun. If I thought a consequence might be suffered, fuck that. We got to get rid of that consequence. Those consequences are for Bloody Rose. Consequences are for Bloody Rose. So it's a fine line to walk, as you said, but I think it can pay off so much if a book can be funny and also serious, because I feel like life is like that. You know, I've never been to a funeral where people aren't cracking jokes. Maybe I've been to the wrong funeral, but like,
oh no, those are the right,
That's the right one.
Those are the right funerals.
Yeah. So when a fantasy book goes by and there is no jokes, I'm just like, those aren't real people. Right. They never once like said something goofy or silly or stumbled or fell or.
It's a great point of even someone like Joe Abercrombie, and who is, you know, he's what, if you bring up the concept of grimdark, he's poster boy of grimdark fantasy.
Poster man.
Hopefully we have one here. The poster boy.
Poster child.
Now, that guy does have a great beard, though. Like, yeah. Man's beard. Anyway. Grimdark, a fantasy, and yet he has some of the funniest characters. Some of the funniest moments in his books.
Yeah.
And, like, yeah, humor
which kind of highlights
not
the grimdark, I imagine. Right? When you have something funny and then serious.
I don't want to brag here, but currently reading this bad boy.
Oh, come on. Is that in the ARC?
Almost done it. It's before the ARC, believe it or not.
Wow.
Because I'm told that if I get a blurb in, I might be able to be on the ARC, which would be great publicity for me. But it is his best book yet, I think. It's definitely his funniest book by a landslide.
Holy crap. Wow. Holy crap. That's got to feel good that you get to do blurbs for other authors. That's the coolest.
I mean, my greatest achievement, my two greatest achievements, I'm on a blurb for a Joe Abercrombie book.
Yeah.
I think Best Served Cold. Not Best Served Cold. Little Hatred. And I'm on a blurb for a Guy Gavriel K book, which is...
No. Okay. What's the blurb say?
I can't remember. It's a pretty long one. The one for Guy Gavriel K. And my editors, obviously they knew I liked him, and they went to this party with his editor, and they end up sending me like a paper. Do I have it here? Yeah, I'll just show you. It's really awesome.
That's so cool. Oh, we're in for a treat, Rich.
This
is great. We have nothing of that much value here.
Hey, we got Sanderson that...
Oh, the signed Sanderson. I take that back.
We got that.
Thank you, Jamie.
Okay, so this is what it looks like. It's like a printer version of it. And it's got, I don't know if you can see, it's got like the printer alignment dots inside.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's just like bound with like a black thing. Anyways, it's like, when I got it, I was like, I had friends that were like, oh, can I read it afterwards? I'm like, no. No, you can't read it afterwards. Can you touch like, you know, parts of the cross? No. So I read it and I sent in a blurb, but was not hopeful. And then one day he posted a picture of the back cover and I was on it and I was just like, what is happening here?
What a freaking dream.
But sorry to derail the conversation. The point was that Joe Abercrombie is so funny in every paragraph I find.
Yeah.
Even though he's grim.
The thing is the humor makes it funnier, vice versa. The humor makes the grimdark stuff worse, and then the darkness of the world makes the jokes funnier. It's I think even derail it even further. There's kind of a more famous clip of Jack Nicholson in The Departed, and I believe it's Matt Damon talking about this whole scene that Jack Nicholson talked about.
It's so good.
It's amazing.
So good.
basically, this whole scene of Jack Nicholson character is just supposed to shoot this person on the ground. It's a flashback scene. And Jack Nicholson says, well, I have an idea. Well, if you keep the camera rolling, I shoot the person kneeling on the ground. And I look over to my friend and say, you know, she fell funny. Now, that's a pretty messed up thing to say. And that humor makes the whole situation of how evil and twisted he is so much worse. Mm-hmm. And so that's a really dark thing to find, is a dark character finds humor in really awful things, but also a very positive character and a hopeful character can find jokes in a very tense and awful situation.
Yeah.
So... yeah, in almost all contexts, humor can make a story better, whether it's a sad, dark, happy, light story.
Absolutely. And that's a good point with, I love that, the opposites emphasize the opposite emotion. And since you were clearly going for fun and humor in Kings of the Wild, that's your style, and then Bloody Rose is more the consequences. But when you were, humor's that first thing, you were saying how, hey, like funeral without laughs, or there's always a joke made, and it doesn't feel like a real world if there isn't humor.
What else is essential to a book like that? Well, humor is obviously your go-to, but are there other qualities in life that you just go, okay, this has to be in these books. It's fantasy, but to actually feel like a real world, one, there has to be humor. What else do you think that there needs to be some sort of romance? Do you think that there needs to be anything else to make it feel like, hey, this is a real person. They're really living a real life.
I mean, it doesn't necessarily, I wouldn't like make a checklist that a book has to have it, that I, especially that I was reading, but one that I was writing, it definitely has to have. I mean, and I think is evident in Kings of the Wild. And I think hopefully as a writer, I'll get better. And I feel that I do it character wise much better in Bloody Rose is just having care. Like people feel like emotions and say what they're feeling, whether it's like the brotherly love, like when this is somewhat spoilers, but when the band is all kind of like together at the end and they say, I love you to each other. Just like moments like that, that you might say in real life, you know? Right. And then also some kind of like, because I love Guy Gabriel Kay, I love a really good paragraph, like a scene, like one that just like leaves the book behind, the rest of the story behind, and just like nails it and tries to say something poetic or profound, even if it doesn't fit with necessarily what's around it. One I can think of is from Kings of the Wild is like when they have the fight in the woods where everyone's fighting their double and Ganelon's fighting his. And there's a line about like, what does a mirror know? Like, what can it show us of ourselves? It shows us the scars, but not the wounds, kind of stuff like that. So to me, I have to have some really, really like, I try to get some really beautiful paragraphs in there.
Have you considered epigraphs?
At the end? Oh, at the beginning.
At the beginning with having a little bit of a, you know, having your Dune-esque, your little, you know, getting a really, but
those were definitely some of the most beautiful parts of Dune.
They're so beautiful.
Like, all of the best quotes really have to have some.
Would you ever do epigraphs?
I would probably do. I feel they would fit better in a different book, like a book that requires more world building than mine.
Yeah. Fair.
And like, I mean, Steven Erikson is another great example of like, he's got profound ones, you know?
Right.
But to be honest, like when I started writing Kings of the Wild, I've been writing, and you may have like heard this before in my other one, but I'd been writing another book for about 12 years that was very serious. No goblins, no orcs, just human beings. And it was the kind of book that I wanted to read from like my whole like 25 to 35. And if you had handed me Kings of the Wild, I would have seen the word centaur and been like, fuck this, I'm out. I'm a grown ass man. But then
and now finally, you write dick jokes.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I mean, that humor is going to last until I'm 90 years old.
Hey, that's the oldest. You look at old Greek art, like ruins, exactly. And there are drawings of penises in the ruins, like from the time. Like dick jokes have been with us forever.
They're timeless.
If I don't see one of your future books, a paragraph that's going really deep and philosophical about how those kind of jokes are just very needed and timeless in all of history. Yes. That's what we need.
See, that
one epigraph. Epigraph in his book about dick jokes. That's
the scene. Is perfect. Character makes a dick joke, and then another character comes along and says, like, this is such a serious situation. We need to, like, where are you, like, taking out your penis in this such a serious situation, you need to get it together. This is not appropriate. And goes into a nice long paragraph talked about from the beginnings of time itself. Man,
perhaps even an essay, why we need dick jokes.
Yes.
Yeah, right there.
We
yeah.
expect this. Yeah. Stop writing your next book.
Well, I think you're going to like the new Abercrombie that way then, because it's like, I feel that he takes every chance he can to be funny in this new
book. Awesome.
And I think it's awesome.
That's so cool. Then the tough thing is the people that love your book versus didn't love your book. It's everyone has different style of humor, and it's really hard to get. I think what Pratchett does geniusly is that somehow he gets humor that hits for a ton of people, but is also niched. It's so strange because it's kind of timeless humor. Just
most of his jokes, as I was mentioned before, have multiple punchlines. Like the punchline where you can get the reference joke. Like it's a reference to a different fantasy trope, or it's a reference to a religious, reference to a religion, reference to a philosophy, or it's the exact same joke is a situational joke of
self-referential,
in the character or a reference to another part of the book. But there, depending on what you want in a joke, he normally has that aspect of the joke. And it's the same joke. That's why I think it hits everyone.
And whereas with Kings of the Wild, I think it's fair to say, at least in our book club, generally it can be trending more toward like, ah, the boys back together, guy humor style yeah. stuff, where like the woman in our book club liked it less, didn't like the humor as much. Whereas yeah. generalizing, of course, there's plenty that do love your book, I'm sure. Yeah. But generalizing, being like, hey, the humor can be for a certain age range. It could be for a certain, like, hey, we didn't get some of the references, so the humor would work more for this group. But with your humor, did you know, like, hey, this is what I find funny. I'm going to try to make people laugh too. It's going to work for those. And that's why people did love it.
Yeah, it was. I mean, at the time, I actually hadn't read any Terry Pratchett. I hadn't read Terry Pratchett until the book was already bought. And then I read Going Postal for the first time. So the only two books that I'd read that had humor in them were, anything Joe Abercrombie, obviously, even though even if he doesn't try to be funny, his voice is kind of like humorous. And then Scott Lynch's Liza Lacamoira had humor in it. Mm. But I was trying to be funnier than I had ever read. You know, and obviously like trying hard. And to that end, like I was so lucky to find like an agent that liked it and was willing to take a chance on that. And then it got picked up by two publishers at the same time. One of them wanted the humor gone, Moog gone, all the music references gone, Abercrombie Light. And that's what it would have been. What? And I think it would have failed miserably.
Why did they even try and pick that up if they wanted?
But probably because the writing is so phenomenal, I think. I'm just kidding. but luckily I found like Lindsay, who is my editor, my original editor at Orbit, and she was willing to take a chance. And publishing it pretty rarely does that on a book that's trying to be that funny, that had that many music references. And you also take a risk. Like there's lots of times you put a reference in there and you're going to pull the reader out of it. You know, like I know Brandon Sanderson, his whole thing is the opposite. He tries to like tone down crazy prose, tone down stuff so that you're just focused on it. Whereas to me, what was important was that someone reading the book would think this writer likes the same things I like. They love the same things I love, or like we have this thing in common. So whether it's like a deep cut Hobbit reference at the beginning of one of the chapters. And if someone gets that, they're just like, they're going to be snapped out of the book, but they're going to go like, fuck, man, like I appreciate that, and then get back into it because it's not that hard to get back into it.
Oh, we totally noticed that. There were a bunch of times where there would just be real world quotes that even didn't get the band references as much, where I'll go like, oh yeah, that reminds me of this, and then go like, okay, now I'm back in the book. So you would have but that was all intentional, clearly.
Yeah, and you like, you're gonna piss some people off. Like there's that cake is a lie joke, you know,
which, yeah
you know, to most people it's from Portal, but to me it was from Dragon Age, because Dragon Age had a Portal joke in it. And to me, if someone reading that goes, hey, I like Dragon Age or I like Portal, that's to me worth breaking the immersion, because it's not like a hard book to get back into, and they'll read the rest of the book like just having something in the back of their head that goes, this person is my people too.
What do you think about, I think Sanderson had something to say on this too, but I'm curious what you think on whose book is it after it's published of, it's your book, but how much do you allow it to like the readers or the audience to take, not that they own the book, and obviously we can get into copyright law and all that, like when do you no longer own the rights to your book, and you also are writing something that was inspired and ideas came from before you, and you're writing something new. So we can talk about all that, but just going, whose book is it, and can everybody get their own thing? Is your book a separate book than the book someone else is reading? And if that makes any sense to both of you.
Sanderson talked about that briefly.
Yeah.
During the time that the reader is reading it, it becomes theirs. And like it is equal part the reader's as it is the author's. I think that's how Brandon Sanderson put it.
That seems right. Yeah. What do you think, Nick?
The same, because ultimately you can't control how someone's going to feel about it. Right. You know, you can just do your best and hope that they like the same things you like. And obviously it means, like, I've had lots of people say, are you a dad? I'm not. Were you in the military? I'm not. Were you in a band? Nope. but to them, it has those connotations. Great. It means things to them, especially to fathers. It's almost other people's books more than it is mine, simply by putting stuff on the page that other people will relate to that I don't necessarily relate to myself.
Wow. There's also the aspect of every writer, and in all honesty, every single creative is not making something wholly original within their own head. They're pulling from the things that they've consumed and things that they've read, of clearly from your book. huge Dungeons and Dragons references of like the world in Kings of the Wild is, I mean, yes, it's your world, but also many of the aspects you didn't come up with, you're pulling from other things, and you're just remixing it into your version of something you've read before.
Yeah.
So how, so the next person who reads your book and then pulls from it and starts and has a different world, but with bands of mercenaries, and they call them the same things that they pulled from your work.
Like their joke comes from Portal, then Dragon Age, then from your book, but they, it's just a line of.
But the point is, like, the author can't own 100% of the ideas of their book. Once it's been read, it's going to be a part of the next work if it's incorporated. Well, hopefully, you know, when it's good. That's the same thing with how Tolkien basically spawned however many fantasy books after him. Same thing with Dune.
Yeah. And part of my whole thing was to take from other books. Like, I feel like ultimately it's a book, as you guys, I think, said in your review, that someone who loves those band references and stuff like that. I feel when I was writing it, and even today, I feel that it's a book for people that are, if either read a ton of fantasy and that are past their, like, or not past there, but like have read their, you know, their great world building, their deep structures, their magic systems, their all that stuff, and just want something that's got everything and a bit more lighthearted, like a, very much like a palate cleanser almost, or just something that's like hopeful and fun and funny. Or someone who has never read a fantasy book, because I've spent my life trying to get non-fantasy readers to read fantasy books. And the moment they get to an epitaph, they're just like, what the fuck is this? I'm out of here. Right? That's one of the reasons they don't exist in Kings of the Wild, because it's too much of a fantasy trope. It's, I mean, it's in other books, but it's just too much to ask of, for instance, my mom. And I wanted people to give their moms or their uncles or their dads this book and go, just, I know you like think I'm weird for reading fantasy books. You might like this because it's got that music reference kind of like in, and it's very careful in the first, say, three or four chapters to keep, like, I made a point of keeping like the names, like Clay, Gabe, simple names, you know, not very fantasy. And they reference like a centaur and a cyclops, but it's immediately made like a joke. So that a non-fantasy reader goes, okay, that is goofy. I know,
right.
You know, and also to use those monsters, because, you know, if you call your monster a Gorlok or something, like, my mom doesn't care to know what a Gorlok is. I do. Like, if I read a book and it's got a new monster in it, I'm all for it. But non-fantasy readers don't care, and they'll just bounce off it. So I wanted to kind of use, or at least like start using, before I dump everything in the kitchen sink on them, simple monsters and simple like world building. It's like, okay, I can get into this. And then suddenly you're just choking on every conceivable creature known to mankind.
And that's awesome to both. That makes so much sense reading your book going, hey, this isn't for, you're not looking for a world building that's going to like describe everything intimately. But still, Mass Fantasy Book Reviews, the 5-star, said this is his favorite fantasy book. So at the same time, you both made it an intro to fantasy for some people, but also made a fantasy, like, Matt knows this. He's a fantasy nerd. We're fantasy nerds. He's read a crap ton of fantasy books, and you still managed to get, because you had your target niche, you had your intention, you still pleased the fantasy reader, which is, that it doesn't seem like you went broad saying, hey, I'm going to go in, my humor is going to land for every single person ever. So for that big thing you brought up at the beginning, Rich, of going, hey, you don't try to please everybody, please who you can. Because, for example, that editor you sent it to who wanted to scrap this, make it Abercrombie light.
Yeah.
Or agent. Was it agent, editor?
I was an editor, yeah.
Editor, yeah, who wanted to scrap that. Clearly, the book wasn't for that editor. Clearly the wrong audience. And then do you ended up finding, was it Lindsay?
And there was actually, before I got my agent, there was an agent that I had sent my previous book to that said, I'm not going to take this, but I'll read whatever you write next. And I sent this to him, and he was, I think in his 50s, British guy. He got every single reference, and he made me, there is a case of someone gets too many of them and doesn't like them. He also was like, this is too obvious. Like things like, Clay's nickname being Slowhand, he said everyone knows that Slowhand is Eric Clapton's nickname, and I was like, buddy, I assure you nobody under the age of 40 in North America knows that, and
including us,
nobody, you know. Nobody. I didn't, and he's like, no, everyone does. And Moog, for instance, is named after a keyboard brand, and he was like, no, you got to change this. And so he made me change. I was like, can I change one of them? So I took away Slow Hand's name for him and I made tons of changes. Some of them end up being phenomenal changes, but you know, even like Calyrek was an orc. And then in the book, he's a human with a nickname being the orc because he wanted it less fantasy. Mm-hmm. But ultimately he made it a better book, but he eventually said no. So I was able to like put those things back in.
Okay. Wow. So when you were going through, apologies, when you're going through that whole process of getting an editor and finding an agent,
yeah,
how did you go about that? Because as us for writers or anybody watching, how was that process of reaching out to people and achieving your dream? What did you do to get there?
Well, with my, I'd sent query letters out. I think I'd probably made them like every mistake in the world when I first started. I was sending them out before I finished my first book, which was like a 300,000 word epic, like fantasy book. And then I end up, everyone was like, this is too big. And so I cut it in half and reworked the first half and send that out. And then while I was sending that out for the third time was when I had come up with the idea for Kings of the Wild, thought somebody had to have written this book before. And I Googled it and it was like, no one has written this. I better do it. But I wrote the first three chapters and then I put it away for another year to work on this other book. But eventually while I was writing it, this author named Sebastian de Castel, who wrote The Traitor's Blade, came into my restaurant that I was working at. I saw his name on the reservation list and I'm like, put this guy in my section. I think he's this author that I really like. And I was like, hey man, I was the first person to ever recognize him in public. And I was like, I'm a writer too. And he was so gracious about it. And then I was like, I'm working on this book. And he's like, oh, great. And then I saw him at the Vancouver Writers Festival a few months later and he remembered who I was. And he was like, how's that book come along? I'm like, oh, it's done. I've got this agent that's like working on it with me. And he knew who the agent was. The agent was like, it's a really good agent. And he was like, that's great. And then he came into my restaurant again about 5 months later. And I was like, oh, this guy just dropped me. He's decided not to go with it. And he's like, well, tell you what, I'll give it to my agent. But she's turned down all my friends. So don't get your hopes up. And then his agent, one day I got this email and I was skipped to the end to see the part where they say, sorry. And instead it said, I would like to offer you representation. And
wow.
I said, Mom, stop the car. Yeah. But yeah, so it was like, I kind of a stroke of luck that way. At the same time I was sending it out to other agents since that one guy said no. And right after I got my agent, another agent did say, hey, is this still available? And it wasn't, but, yeah, so just query letters and then obviously a bit of a stroke of luck and a very gracious author.
That's fantastic. It seems to be the case where it always includes, there has to be some element of luck and obviously effort on your part, but then sometimes you need that extra.
Luck requires opportunity.
Yeah. And you put yourself in enough.
Opportunity is what you make of it. You can make yourself up. Like you can put yourself in opportunist positions.
Right. Like if we call more books, like we have just more provocative thumbnails going like, oh my goodness, George R. Martin's Song of Ice and Fire sucks. And then George reaches out to us. That's what'll happen, right? I'm pretty sure.
maybe a Pure Senior review that says trash.
Exactly. Susanna, let's go.
You'll be doing an interview with her before you know it.
Nick, thank you so much for this. We wanted to end with some of our patrons' questions who we reviewed Kings of the Wild on our Patreon exclusive Discord. You can check the description below for that. And also for Nick's book, Kings of the Wild, we'll all be there. We just wanted to end with a question or two. I think three. We'll give them maybe two or three.
Excellent.
Yeah. Three. And also, I just want to make clear a comment from one of our Patreon members, Coop. So if you've also read Kings of the Wild, and maybe you watched our review of it and thought similar to us, you liked it. However, I think, Nicholas, you mentioned this before, Coop here liked Bloody Rose quite a bit more than Kings of the Wild. And I think a lot of that was the consequences is things like, I don't want to spoil, but there's a couple moments in the book where could have been hard consequences, but was retracted.
I know exactly the one you're talking about.
Yeah.
Reason is because I got a great joke about starfish, something smelling like starfish. Yeah.
But Coop said that Bloody Rose is an amazing book. He really loved it. So wanted to give that comment out as well.
Fantastic. Thank and you, we'll too. Start with, want me to ask this question first? Then you ask
yeah.
it? Okay, perfect. This is from Andrew, our patron Andrew. And the reason I'm doing Andrew first is he's the one that pitched Kings of the Wild to us, and he loves you. He is jealous he's not here right now. We're Andrew, you'll never make it here. Andrew is great, and he loves your book, just wants to let you know how much he loves it, and it means so much to him. It's one of his favorite fantasy books ever. And he asks you, what other series / books are your biggest influences and inspirations for writing books in this series? And on top of that, who are some of your favorite authors that have influenced your writing as a whole? I know we touched on this a bit, but maybe so beyond Guy Gavreau Kay, is there another one you'd want to elevate or also mention?
Yeah, I mean, like I mentioned, before, like Joe Abercrombie and Scott Lynch were huge inspirations, yep. only because they kind of like had comedy in their books that I'd never read before. The book Ready Player One was actually instrumental to me writing this book because although it isn't like, say, beautiful prose wise, it was a book that I could, when I read it, I love video games. And even though the video games it mentioned were like a bit before my time, I still like that his love for games was so evident and so on display. And I was like, that is 100% is like I'm writing this book, a fantasy book that has no fantasy elements in it. Just so it can fit in with every other book in 2015, you know? I'm like, why don't I write something that has all the fantasy elements? So Ready Player One was a huge influence on me just because it was like everything in the kitchen sink when it came to video games. And then these days, there's an author named Christopher Buhlmann who wrote The Black Tongue Thief, which is a phenomenal book. And it is just, it's got such a hilarious voice. And that is an inspiration to me as well.
I actually did notice some similarities between, in many ways, humor is kind of similar of Grim World, but with a funny,
yeah,
because the character's funny. It makes the
same editor, book. Same editor. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That makes right. sense.
I did enjoy, I also read Between Two Fires as well, which is,
that's awesome too. Yeah.
Very, very different style book, but I'm surprised they're kind of written by the same author. They're
yeah.
so very different.
But, well, even the Black Tongue Thief prequel that comes out next week, I want to say, or in a couple of weeks, The Daughter's War, it's very, very different because it's the same world, but it's from the point of view of a different character who's utterly humorless. So it's got some, like, you know, still the great writing, still some profound stuff in it, but it's not like funny like the way Black Tongue Thief is funny.
Hmm.
But phenomenal book. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, so that was a question from Andrew. Do you want to go ahead and ask from, is it Salty? Salty Sea Sport, Caleb, yep. Our guy Caleb. Yeah.
Our guy Caleb, or goes by Salty on our Discord, asked, since this is clearly D&D inspired, have you ever played D&D yourself? And if so, what class would you pick? And if not, what class would you want to, if not, what class would you want to play as?
Yeah, I've played a lot of D&D, as should probably be evident from reading that book.
Yeah.
And like that too was something that's like, in it, like my D&D sessions are not super serious. We have a little M&M guy that you can pull his hand and M&Ms spill out. And whenever you roll a 20, you get to a handful of M&Ms. And whenever you roll a 1, you have to swig this awful like scotch that we've bought.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. That so, it does great. make sessions a lot more fun and funny and lots of jokes and humor. So I have played it and it was a very huge inspiration on those books. As far as characters I like to play the most, I feel like I do like to play like elves, obviously, because I'm a Legolas stan from way back in the day. And yeah, wizards or bards, maybe. Big fan of bards, despite the fact that I kill them constantly.
That is probably your...
That's a great one.
It's one of the funniest jokes in it, just the idea that the bards just keep dying.
And it's so realistic, too. It's like, why would they not die?
Totally. I mean,
it makes perfect
They're
sense.
They're just a bystander. Yeah. Yeah. That actually, that joke is from, because I remember you guys are talking about it. It's from the movie, This is Spinal Tap. It's a reference to that, because in Spinal Tap, their drummers mysteriously die of like, they combust or they just, something stupid happens to them. And they just don't know what's going on. And so it was kind of a reference to that.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And we got one last question from the patrons, and this is from Tom. Thank you, Tom, for sending this. Do you think that Tudor Ramble is mid?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Below mid or worse?
No, it's phenomenal. I mean, because you guys both, like, you're very, very honest about what you like in books. You know, you're not saying, I mean, I haven't listened to all your reviews, obviously, but if you say you don't like something, you explain why you don't like it, and you don't like it for very rational reasons, not just because, you know. And yeah, you obviously love books, and listening to you guys talk, and to be honest, it's the case sometimes a lot when two people talk about Kings of the Wild and they may or may not have liked it as much as I would wish them to, they end up liking it more in just talking to each other about it, because there's certain, they're like, oh yeah, that was funny. Oh yeah, that was good. Oh, I didn't get that. Oh, that's why that happened. And so I love to hear people deep dive it. And I thought it was an extremely thoughtful, extremely like, yeah, it was just a well done, thorough review.
Thank you for letting us fish for that compliment. But that is so true for books that we've read and then get to talk about one of the main reasons we made this channel to,
yeah,
get deep into every single book and then have a community to talk with about it. And we always reflect on the books generally more positively months after having had that conversation. That we're having this whole series now where we're looking at books that we really liked and enjoyed, and then end up looking more fondly because all the good stuff remains and the negative stuff kind of goes away over time, especially when 100%. You talk about it with someone.
And maybe the little pet peeves that bothered you when you just finished it, but now that it is, it's like, it doesn't feel as important anymore.
Yeah,
exactly.
Hey, if I can put one of your pet peeves to rest, when I was listening to your review, you guys were talking about Larkspur coming back for Ganelon, and that it wasn't believable.
Yeah, please.
Right?
Yeah.
And granted, this is 100% my fault for not making it evident. And I, you know what? I also thought, God, it would be cool to have like a, actually, your guys' review made me think of a couple more lines I would like to put in there. But Larkspur came back. Yeah, Larkspur came back for because of Clay. She came back because he hesitated on that bridge. I don't want to spoil too much. Because he hesitated. She didn't, but he did. And you she thought about that afterwards and was like, fuck, what kind of asshole am I? You know, like Ganelon thought, if Clay Cooper didn't like me, you know, what? Who am I? And that's kind of what happened with Larkspur. And also when he came back, she thought he was dead. And he came back for his one friend and risked his life. And she sees that again in his eyes. And so like, yes, like Ganelon's just a, you know, passing thing for her. Clay is the reason she came back.
God, that clears it up for you. Okay. It makes more sense for her.
It makes a lot more sense because, from my head of going like, she's going after Ganelon.
Yeah.
I'm like,
exactly. 100%.
Got it.
And it's not thoroughly explained in the book by any means. Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. You know, I don't often get to have my questions.
All your time, he's like, hey, explain this. Yeah, just tell me.
Why the fuck did you do this? Please.
This is Chris Evans Speedell. Like, Bloody Rose does.
And one thing, the other thing was like with Gabe's character, which maybe if there's like an adaptation someday, I could add it in there. But like, I would love to have a part where Gabe says that he's like the reason why he's going after Rose so hard. Is but like he's a hero to everyone except her, you know, and like she's the only, almost the only person on earth that doesn't think, oh my God, Gabe, you're so amazing, and so he's doing it to prove that to himself, but to be her hero. But
got it. That makes a bunch of sense. And what we're gonna do based on this episode is definitely read Bloody Rose at some point and Guy Gavril K.
That's also the nice thing is I haven't read Bloody Rose yet. I've had it on my shelf here. Awesome. And our difference of reading the books, like I read the book well over a year ago and you read it recently.
Yes.
So we can actually read it
together.
Closer together and it'll be a bit. So I was going on mostly reflection and after conversation. So this will be a different kind of review.
Well, I appreciate you having the books right behind your head as well.
Oh, ain't that nice?
Free advertising, yeah.
Prime real estate up here.
Oh, right there, yes.
Yeah.
Nick, thank you so much for coming on. And if you want to promote, we're going to have your books in the description below for everybody. Any links that you want to send us to send people to, do you want to promote anything? This is your chance. Not that we haven't been promoting your stuff already, but what would you like to say to the audience?
No, nothing at all. Just I got nothing to promote. If you've read my book already, then I am so eternally grateful for you. If you didn't like it, I'm sorry I wasted your time. If you've read Kings of the Wild and decide to give Bloody Rose a shot, I'm much more proud of, and I'm proud of both books, but I think Bloody Rose is definitely ultimately a better book. I hope you guys enjoy it when you do read it. But I'm not. You can just absolute trash the shit out of it. Do not worry about my feelings.
Oh, don't you worry.
Excellent.
Well, we feel more comfortable now, so we can.
really, it was 100%. A two-star. We were just being nice. No.
Also, now you can just email and be like, what the fuck was this about? You know?
Yeah. Nick, thank you so much. Rich?
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you again so much for this. This was a lot of fun for us. And for you guys watching, bye-bye, y'all.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.